The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to this special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm James Hill. I'm delighted to be joined today by Simon Hart, former Welsh Secretary and Chief Whip. He has just written the first diaries of a Chief Whip that have come out. Simon, welcome. Thank you for joining us here at The Spectator today.
Thanks, thank you.
So first of all, I suppose just ask, you know, why did you decide to blow the lid about what was like life in the Whip's office? There's always been a bit of a code of immurta around that. Why now?
There has. I mean, I started the whole diary thing back in 2010 because my kids were 8 and 10 or 8 and 6 at the time. I wanted something to show them in 25 years' time, with, you know, where I'd been for that sort of missing 15 years of their lives. So that's how it all started. And then, but there was a slightly more serious element to this when I was doing stuff within government, which was there was some comic, you know, darkly comic elements of it. There were some extraordinary moments where you just thought, you know, you couldn't make it up type moments. And I actually just thought it would be useful to have some kind of a record, which hopefully was not, you know, too overly serious, but made a serious point about life not being straightforward, and not being straightforward in anything any of us do, and in government and in parliament and in politics, it's just as complicated and just as unpredictable as in any other walk of life. And I thought that you know, just shining a bit of a light on that would be interesting and helpful.
I mean, there's a huge amount of your career before you become Chief Whip in October 2022, and you take over after the Liz Truss interregnum, shall we say, post Boris Johnson. But I'm a little bit interested in also in a few months prior to that, when you resign as Welsh Secretary. And I think that was in some ways sort of the day when it sort of helped bring down, you know, Boris Johnson, but it seemed like the end of the road for a lot of people in his government who have been quite close to him. Sort of talk me through that period and how difficult that was, given, you know, how he'd given you the cabinet role in the first place.
Incredibly difficult, because it's easy to interpret a resignation as being a sort of an act of deliberate aggression. I remember thinking, as did lots of others, I think we were into our, you know, 54th resignation in a matter of days by the time I got round to it. I remember agonising over it, and I sort of still agonising over it now, because, you know, Boris had plucked me from relative obscurity. He'd put his faith in me in a number of roles, and, you know, it did trouble me that, you know, is this the way you repay that? Mm-hmm. And yet, strangely, the moment when I remember it well, sort of ending up in the cabinet room of just me, him, and the then Chief Whip. And I just remember it being the probably the warmest, most friendly conversation of any I ever had with him, was the one in which I said, look, Boris, you know, with this, you know, whichever way you look, whichever route you take, you know, somebody's going to try and bring you down. So there's a sort of easy way and a hard way of doing this. And it was much, much harder than I thought it would be. And he was much more generous and forgiving and patient than I expected him to be. And you know, one of the things I say about Boris is, was impossible not to like. He was always entertaining. I think his political instincts were, by and large, very, very sharply honed. But he was prone to sometimes listen to poor advice. And I remember so many times when he was very honest about things, and he'd say, you know, the day after the latest catastrophe, he'd say, I knew I shouldn't have let them do that. I knew it was a mistake. I don't know what possessed me. Why did I listen to these people? And so his instincts were right, but then something would happen and knock him off course a bit. And that made it harder, because, as I say, he was, I felt, you know, I owed him quite a bit. But, you know, we parted, you know, For old cricketers listening to this, he used to remind me of David Gower when he played for England. You know, brilliant on his day. Nobody could be better on his day. But he occasionally sort of threw his wicket away needlessly. and you used to think, oh, come on, David, you can do better than that. Mm. And occasionally with Boris, says, oh, come on, Boris, you know this is crazy. Stop it. But, you know.
And after Boris, then comes Liz Truss, and then comes Rishi Sunak. And he then, the end of October 2022, has to rebuild a very divided party back together. And he turns to you to be his enforcer. And you mentioned there about resigning with the chief whip there. When you were taking up that role, did you turn to anyone for advice? Did you read any sort of past accounts? What did you get inspiration from when you were taking on a very difficult role with a very divided party at that time?
Yeah, it was not that that is a very good sort of summary of the situation at the time. I remember when I sat down in the, I think the first cabinet meeting we had when Rishi was prime minister, and noticing that there were seven former chief whips around the table, including the editor of The Spectator, as it turned out. So that I thought then there's going to be no shortage of advice about how to do this job. And so it turned out to be. And actually, most of it was incredibly helpful. But we were in difficult territory. You know, we had a party that was, you know, 13 years into a spell of government. That's a long time at the helm. We had a number of people who had felt that their sort of moment in the sun had come to an end. It wasn't an easy set of circumstances, and so I know that Rishi's intentions and ambitions at that time were to try and build a coalition of interests and beliefs as best we could, and to be patient, and to be professional, and to recognise that there were people who'd been very loyal to Boris, loyal to Liz Truss, people who'd supported Penny Mordaunt or Tom Tugendhat, or, you know, there were numerous different interest groups within the party, and to try to get them to coalesce around a particular agenda at that time and a particular leader at that time, with an election not that far off. You know, we knew it was coming in a couple of years. That was going to be very difficult.
And talk me through that sort of 18-month spell then between October 2022 and July 2024. I mean, reading through your diaries, it seems that over time, your sense of even-handedness just becomes frustration at the contrast between the professionalism of Rishi Sunak. I think everyone would say that in the parliamentary party, even his bitterest critics, the professionalism of Rishi Sunak and his integrity with, frankly, the amateur way some people were behaving.
Well, it was one of the themes, the more serious themes, which I've tried to sort of touch on in the book, is the fact that almost every day that I was in the Whip's office, there was a moment when I would, in a moment of exasperation and a sort of fit of pique, I would sort of shake my head and say, you know, how did we get to this position? You know, what have we done wrong? You know, why is this so complicated? Because ultimately, you know, as the people know with the Whip's office, it's, you know, you deal with numbers. You know, it's everything is predicated with the question, can we win a vote? And one of the things which struck me was we had a lot of very good people, very good MPs, very good colleagues, very principled people with very clear ideologies. But sometimes I felt that they didn't understand quite how, you know, this was a numbers game. This was the art of the possible. This wasn't fulfilling dreams. This was, how could we win a vote? We only needed, most of the time I was chief whip, we only needed 25 of our people to align with the opposition, and we would lose. And by lose, I don't mean just lose a vote. In some cases, that was potentially going to bring down the government. So we were always a non-complicated, challenging piece of legislation around things like the Rwanda policy. You know, we were the reality that we were facing was the end of the government. And so I did keep coming to the conclusion that what was the root cause of this? The root cause of this sometimes was not the individual colleagues who believed strongly that their way was the only way. It was that we weren't actually either selecting candidates or training candidates or preparing candidates or mentoring candidates in a way that set them up to best cope with the pressures of modern politics. And we had lots of people who were brilliant on their policy area, second to none, but weren't so good at compromise, disappointment. You didn't quite see that sometimes it was better to get, you know, 10% of something rather than no percent of anything. And that was really challenging. That was very, very difficult. And trying to persuade people that, you know, the only way we were going to make progress is with a significant concession for people who were ideologically attached to their particular belief. That was it. And I think that's not a fault of theirs. To some extent, it wasn't a fault of the government. It was a fault of the system that we hadn't got people prepared for that. It should almost be part of basic training for candidates.
And of course, it's changed dramatically from, say, the 1980s, when there was that culture fostered in the party of sort of veterans, and a number of them had, you know, the whips in the Thatcher's office who sort of had MCs, etc. And there was that collegiality, their esprit de corps. And you see that in the votes. You can measure that empirically. The number of rebelliousness has really increased over the past 20, 25 years or so. It's sometimes said that the whips office needs to decide whether it's a HR department or a Sandhurst barracks. I just wondered which was the approach you chose.
I think we were, I mean, listen, we're in 2023, 2024 now. I think there's an expectation that the WHIPS office reflects, you know, modern working practices as best as possible. And, you know, I sort of flippantly describe ourselves at some stage as sort of a bit of an A&E department. You know, we put people back together and we sent them back out into the open again. It was a bit more than that because we were an HR department, or we tried to be. We were, you know, we helped people through difficult moments. We were, but we were also there to get the business of the government done, and that required being very straightforward with, very direct with ministers and with colleagues. And look, this is, you know, this is our best shot at this. You know, if we lose, you know, Rwanda is a case in point. Not everybody necessarily agreed it, but if we lost it, the penalty was high, the price was going to be high. And we used to say to people, look, if, you know, here's the dilemma. You don't like this policy, fine, but it is the government policy. If you vote down the government policy, the government will fall. That's the reality of this. You, member, you, the MP, have to decide if your particular position on this is so important that you are going to compromise or risk your own political careers and of dozens of colleagues at the same time. And to do that, though, in a way which was, as I say, professional and sensible and carried people with you. And, you know, we did lose a vote, but we only lost one in 2 years. And that was on the issue of infected blood. And we should never have lost that. That was a slip catch. It went down.
And was Rwanda, I mean, I remember those debates in December 2023, January 2024. That was the future of the government. I mean, was that probably the finest hour for the WHIPS office under Rishi?
Some people have said to me, you know, because I've described it like that, and one or two people have said to me, why this was a contentious piece of legislation, was quite divisive. I looked at it in a slightly different way, that this was the circumstances around trying to get Rwanda through to royal assent were very, very challenging. And there were lots of people within government, not including Rishi, I might add, but lots of people in government who didn't think that we would ever get to royal assent. Mm. But they thought that giving it a go was good enough. And I remember having a conversation with Nick True, our leader in the House of Lords at the time, and subsequently with colleagues in Number 10, I was saying, look, can you just make it clear now? Do you want us to succeed? To say, if you want Nick and I to get this through, then please say so now. But if you don't care, please say so now. And I remember getting the instruction from Number 10, no, play to win. Yeah, let's try and get this on the statute book. And as a result of that, we did. And we saw off numerous attempts, not just by the opposition, but by quite a lot of our own people, to derail that policy, including and up to the very dying moments of the debate when we were ambushed in mid-afternoon, a couple of hours away from the most crucial vote. And that was, for me, the moment where, and it was the only time when I was in the WHIPS office when I thought, bloody hell, I'm not sure we can do this. I mean, I genuinely thought from, and it was a misjudgment on my part, because I had underestimated at that stage how good the WHIPS office were then going to be, because I thought we were, you know, as I say, the vote was, I think, at 5 to 7. This was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We had a really invaluable piece of intelligence from a group of people in a room somewhere on the parliamentary estate who were colluding with the opposition to collapse the debate in the middle of the afternoon when nobody was ready, trigger a vote, which we would have probably lost. And we got, thank God, we got an early warning. Somebody realised significant the significance of what was going on. So that would have brought down the government, make no mistake. And we were able to intercept it. And I remember the sort of silence around my office, in the Whip's office, with people from Number 10. There was the special advisors. And like, normally there's a bit of banter and there's a bit of noise. It was deadly silent. I thought, God, this is actually quite serious. You know, we have now got a matter of minutes to rectify this. And everybody did their duty and hit the telephones. Nobody lost their rag. Everybody was calm, probably except me. I pretended to be calm. And at 5 to 7, and Michael Tomlinson, who was the Solicitor General at the dispatch box in the chamber, if anybody deserved a medal that day, it was Michael, because he never missed a beat and he delivered it as if the whole thing had been planned, which, of course, it hadn't been. And we were okay.
And one of those for Rwanda 11, of course, was Robert Jemrick. And he goes from being the Home Office Minister at the end of 2023 to therefore being one of the rebels in 2024. I mean, what was that like to deal with as a whip when you have a resignation like that?
I mean, you know, I've tried in all of this to sort of see the positives in all of our colleagues. And Robert knew what he was doing. And I think I respect people's views on these things, but he had been the minister responsible for all of this subject area. And so I sort of knew what his views were, and I knew what his views were on the proposals that we were making. And so there was a frustration. You know, the thing about this being a diary, not a memoir, is that it reflects how I felt on the day after, you know, 17 hours having, you know, being punched in the face by our colleagues, you know. So some of it appears intemperate and some of it might appear like I'm, you know, disproportionately frustrated. Well, I was, you know, that's how it was on the day. If I'd written it a week later, different thing. If I'd written it a year later, totally different thing. But on the day, and I do remember thinking, I was exasperated because what we were witnessing was very, you know, competent senior people who were dicing with political death. And I, you know, this was, for me, become, you know, Rwanda was just the subject of the day. What we were really dealing with was, as I say, the potential demolition. Forget what happened later in the election, but to that moment in time, the potential demolition of the party, premeditated demolition of the party. And, you know, so it was exasperating. Robert was always polite, don't get me wrong, but, you know, the ambush on that final day in the Rwanda debate, you know, was a deliberate attempt to try and get one over on us. And not only did they fail, but the bit which made it sort of, from an insider's point of view, quite satisfactory in the end is that they all voted with the government once the ambush had been identified and averted.
And to answer a historian's question, to fast forward a few months, May 2024, Rishi Sunak goes to that election, a few weeks after the local elections. Some people thought it would be later in 2024. A minority even thought or hoped it perhaps would be go for January 2025. Do you think the Parliamentary Party, as the chief whip at the time, was ungovernable by that point and they had to go in May 2024 for an election?
I think, by the way, the expression ungovernable isn't something which I apply purely to the Conservative Party. I think in seeing the challenges that Keir Starmer has had to encounter during his first few months of government, I think it's something which actually affects all governments and all party managers. I don't think this is unique to us by any stretch of the imagination. I think, you know, my recollections of that build-up to the July election were, and you won't be surprised to hear this, firstly, there were only ever 3 months of 2024 that could have been an election, to be honest with you. And that was July, October, and November. So the idea that there were multiple options was never a thing, because we were never going to do anything which compromised the May, big mayoral elections in May in places like Teesside and the West Mids. And of the odd conversation I had with the then PM Rishi around that sort of time, it was always about, well, let's see what May produces. Let's see what the result is. You know, if we won 2 out of 3 of the mayoralties, or we lost all three, those have profound effects. And we didn't want at the time, and Isaac Levido, I think, would confirm this, we didn't want at the time to suddenly nationalise those mayoral elections. So we wanted those to be elections in their own right. So people with huge local credibility, like Andy Street and Ben Houchen, could maximise their own personal brand. So we weren't going to get in the way of that. So that ruled out pretty well everything before May. And August and September were ruled out because it was holiday season and nobody was going to have an election anyway. So what did that leave us with? It left us with July or October or November, arguably January 2025. But, you know, the other thing which you'd expect me to say this, wouldn't you? But, you know, the idea that Rishi and his closest people at the time would do anything without incredibly deep and detailed thought.
Yeah, I know.
I remember when I had a conversation with Rishi, not far out from when the announcement was made, I remember him saying to me, I've thought about little else recently. And I remember thinking, yeah, that I believe that, because that's how he approached everything. It was very analytical. It was very thorough. He would have looked at multiple different scenarios. But from where I was, I think this idea that somehow everything was going to be fine in the autumn, well, I'm not really sure where that came from, because it didn't feel like that to me. I mean, I was in a marginal West Wales seat, and I wasn't deaf or blind to the feeling of local residents and the frustrations and the exasperation. So, you know, I remember thinking, and you know, there was no particular evidence to suggest that suddenly, you know, that the economy was going to change. So, we'd pulled the tax cut levers. We'd done all of those things which normally affect bowling.
It didn't really affect the polls as well. I remember
we'd been I put this in the book. But we'd been on a 20-point deficit since about the second week of Liz Truss's premiership, and it hadn't gone up or down by a point. Didn't matter what we did, well or badly, nothing much had changed. And the idea that it was suddenly going to change, when we had, you know, prison places bursting, we had, you know, we were not exactly in the position where we were going to get flights off to Rwanda anytime immediately. We had, quite rocky economic prospects and big, perfectly legitimate payouts for the Post Office Horizon victims and for the victims of infected blood, all these things which were squeezing the sort of what they call the fiscal headroom and all that. The idea that it was suddenly mysteriously going to get better, I thought was pretty naive, to be honest. And one or two friends of mine who, the ones who were very honest with me, when they were saying, oh, you know, let's go long. I said, what do you mean by go long? They said, basically, go never. You know, it was just, let's make this headache, push this headache as far away as possible. Mm. It wasn't, oh, by the way, you know, I think that October's going to be brilliant because it's going to be, you know, massive cut in interest rates or whatever it might be, and suddenly our popularity is going to soar. That was never a consideration. It was hope value, really.
Two things that struck me from reading the diaries, and one of which is the prevalence of the wonderful Emma, your media spat, I know as well. And second of all, I would say the way in which number of sort of HR cases you might have. And I remember, I think it's the Peter Bone one, you talk about how all you can do really is remove the whip. I'm just curious as to how you think about the whip's office handle these cases involving allegations about this kind of nature, about personal conduct, and whether it's now a media thing rather than a parliamentary management one.
Well, you're right in your comments about Emma Pryor, who not only developed a sort of sophisticated, you know, deadpan reaction to anything which came our way, but also became, through necessity, an expert in these particular issues. I thought it was an area which, you know, caused me in many cases the greatest concern of all, because, you know, the Whip's office is a bunch of politicians whose job is to get the business done. You know, we're not financial advisors, we're not lawyers, we're not counsellors. Yet these were all roles that we were occasionally asked to fulfil, and it used to worry me daily that we were being asked to opine on subjects which, in a sense, we were not in really any position to opine. What we were able to do, and I think what Emma and people like Joe Churchill, who was the welfare whip at the time, were very good at doing, is signposting people to the increasingly wide array of very, very good services that the House offers for people who've struck an iceberg somewhere along the line and whose life has suddenly taken a very difficult turn. And to try and, you know, put the victims, if that's the right word, first in that, and then try to, you know, unpick the mess in a way which was fair and equitable and sensible and above all lawful. I sometimes think when it came to the question of sanction, assuming that matters weren't being dealt with by a parliamentary authority or indeed by the police, but where the sanction had to be administered by us, it did trouble me that, you know, sometimes we had the only weapon at our disposal. The only thing was the same for Matt Hancock going on I'm a Celebrity as it was for another colleague who might be the subject of, you know, bullying allegations. Two very different sets of circumstances, yet with apparently the same, you know, all we had was the same, you know, set of equipment to deal with that. And I, you know, and I look back now, I think that should change. I felt it should change at the time. I think it should, and I think if nothing else, we should give MPs an indication that if they, that there's a sort of tariff system, because, you know, unsurprisingly, people like Matt would come to me, you know, they lost the whip, they may have been without the whip for a year, we're coming up to an election, they want to know if they can stand as a Conservative again. You know, when are they going to get the whip back? Well, the question is, it's entirely up to me, it depends what mood I'm in on the day. Mm. And I'm not sure that's completely fair. I think they should know that if they do X, it's a two-year sentence or a three-year sentence or a four-year sentence, or that there's an appeal process. There really isn't an appeal process.
I mean, the way you talk about handling different MPs, I'm reminded of Football Managers. I mean, did you try and handle every MP the same way, or did you sort of know them based on your knowledge? How was it the best way you sort of handled them, both in terms of carrots and of sticks?
I mean, obviously, you know, we had 353 MPs. We didn't have that many at the end, but we started with 353, and that got some whisked away over time. And some had been there 20 or 30 years, and some had been elected in 2019. Some were ministers and were therefore very, you know, low maintenance. They were happily doing their duty in their department. Others were just, you know, very good and loyal, hard-working individuals we never heard from one day to the next, and others, like any family, were more challenging. And but we did always try, and I'm sure somebody will probably, you know, write in or ring in off and say how dismally we failed, but we did always try to be fair and to try to treat everybody similarly. Possibly naively, we also tried to appeal sometimes to their sense of, you know, sort of their sense of loyalty to the party, that actually little would be gained from, you know, dying in a ditch from one issue or another. We always used to, you know, use the expression, as many former chief whips have done, you know, this is not the hill to die on. And sometimes they just said, well, I think it is. And people who were coming to the end of their parliamentary career,
yes,
they'd been a minister, they'd been a trade envoy, they'd got their knighthood, whatever it might be.
There's less sort of...
I didn't have much left in the... I didn't have much left in the toy box, to be honest.
I wanted to say, in terms of the toy box, I mean, because also we've talked about the sort of disciplinary role, but I mean, you suddenly went overnight from being Simon Hart, Simon, to being the chief. You were suddenly the man who could help with preferment, etc. Did you notice just sort of your colleagues treating you differently when you were the chief whip, the man with the Prime Minister's ear?
Yes, I've noticed they're treating me differently since I gave up the role too. Yeah, I mean, Emma Pryor, who we mentioned earlier on, Emma always thought that we should call this book about my knighthood, because the number of times that, you know, just as a colleague left my office and just before they sort of pull the door, they'd lean around and say, oh, by the way, about my knighthood. And it became a bit of a standing joke that was a conversation which massively increased in frequency as we got closer to the election. And, you know, there's no great harm in that. It just was a bit of a running gag in the whip's office. And, you know, it was, again, it turned out to be a much harder era than I originally anticipated, because, yes, it's, you possess significant influence, but also it's not a God-given right, as you know, for anybody, and you know, we always did our best. But Rishi's view was that just being an MP or just being a minister was not necessarily a guarantee that, you know, you picked up an honour as you left the building on your last day. You had to do something which was, you know, over and above what you were required, what you did as part of your paid job, and That raised the bar a bit. I think most people would think that that was reasonable. And so not everybody, I mean, lots of people thought that the bar was in a slightly different place to where I thought it was. And but we always kept hope alive. And I sometimes look back and think, maybe that was a mistake. Maybe I should have been clearer with people on day one that the likelihood was, you know, 10% rather than 60%. And it felt like the right thing to do on the day. And, you know, I was probably genuine in my belief that, you know, with most of it was a possibility. But trouble is, I think I imparted that possibility as a likelihood, and that was possibly a mistake. And obviously, you know, we were in government for a long time, so over a 15-year period, an awful lot of people did. But also a lot of very deserving people come away empty-handed. And I feel, you know, I feel that some of them were quite hard done by.
And as a final question, Simon, I just wondered, I mean, when Giles Brandreth wrote his diaries, Breaking the Code, he said that on the day of publication he received a box with inside it was a sort of black ball and a signal being drummed out by the X-ray whips. Are you worried about the same thing happening when your diaries come out?
No, I mean, I put in the very first chapter of the book, I refer to the fact that, you know, there are some who believe that Chief Whip shouldn't write books, and you know, I can. It's a reasonably, you know, respectable view to hold. But I do think the world has moved on a bit, and I do think that the problem with remaining in a gentlemanly silence indefinitely is the things which have held us back as a party, and the problems which, if we're honest, are staring us in the face will never get properly discussed, and they will never change. And so, sure enough, I will remember, I could, as others might do, remain a member of the club forever, but it'll be an increasingly irrelevant club and an increasingly reduced size club, because we're not dealing with the thing. I mean, we have to deal with the issue of candidate selection and training. We have to do that. And the book helps explain why we have to do that. We have to recognise that we are not operating in the 1970s or the 1960s. We're operating in a very different, under a great deal more scrutiny, where there's much more public expectation, and where the job of whipping is more, is changed. And I don't, you know, I've tried to protect, you know, the identity of people whose lives are complicated enough already without having, you know, having another, you know, public, too much public scrutiny of what went wrong. I've tried to do that. I might have failed, but I tried to do that. But underlying all of this is my intention to just make us think about, you know, what we want the Conservative Party to look like and feel like, and how we should make it something that hundreds and thousands of people yearn to be a member of. But we're not doing that at the moment. In fact, our gene pool is decreasing, not increasing. Till we address these things, that will continue to be the case, and we will not get the broad selection of fantastic candidates that we deserve. And we get some very good ones, but we also get some people. There are some people, and I touch on in the book, who actually we should have helped much more. We should have recognised that not everybody is, you know, got a, you know, ironclad skin, and that being pushed into the limelight, into public office, and all of the scrutiny that involves in 2025 isn't easy to cope with. And we should help them more, because otherwise they'll end up in a difficult position. We don't do that. Until we do that, you know, we can't be surprised when this is. So I've tried to illustrate it as fairly as I can, but either will be the odd person, I've no doubt at all, who will sort of, you know, spit into their port and say, it's not the done thing, old boy. But, you know, I thought about that, and I want this to be helpful. You know, people will obviously express their own views. But
well, Simon, thank you for joining us today and expressing your own views. Appreciate you joining us today on Coffee Hour Shots.